You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Monday, June 3rd, 2013. Sam Cedar sitting in for Tom Hartman. I'm on loan from the Majority Report. Folks, on Friday, the Social Security Trustees Report came out. And this is an occasion where those in the corporate media and the establishment who want to cut Social Security, want to cut our Medicare benefits, this is when we start to hear them crow about how precarious the situation is on those fronts. However, with me now, joining us from Social Security Works, he is the director, the executive director of Social Security Works. You can check him out at strengthensocialsecurity.org. Is my friend Alex Lawson. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, Alex, the report came out on Friday, and maybe one of the things I've noticed is almost the lack of fanfare, because it basically said that Social Security and is not only on sound footing, but Medicare is actually doing better than we had thought it was just last year.
Yeah, that's exactly right. My communications director here at Social Security Works jokingly said the headline should read, Social Security on sound footing, Medicare doing better, public trustees almost look disappointed. And that's because this report really is, as you said, every year this is when you'll see just an avalanche of false stories about how Social Security is going bankrupt. Even though that concept doesn't even make sense for a self-financed program like Social Security. So the fact that the Social Security Trustees report showed that Social Security is unchanged from last year and that Medicare is actually doing better, they really didn't know how to spin that. They would have to have spun really hard to turn that into the negative crisis stories which they really want to tell.
And we have to see this in the context of, the report has always got basically three levels of projections, because so much is tied into how the economy is doing and income inequality, which, you know, it's very tough to measure 20 years out. So there's three different levels of projection. The one that we read about is essentially the one in between, right? Not the most optimistic, but not the most pessimistic.
That's exactly correct. And as you said, what we're looking at are actually projections that go 75 years out into the future. Because Social Security is such a conservatively managed system, that the trustees do this report every single year, and they project out 75 years. There's nothing else like that in the government where they're actually saying, look, we can pay right now 100% of benefits for the next 20 years, and then with no change at all after that, we can still pay 76% of scheduled benefits. So what we're looking at is a projection based on current economic situation. And what I like to say, and is completely true because of the way that Social Security is financed, the absolute best thing that we could do for Social Security is create a bunch of good-paying jobs. Get people back to work, earning wages, and paying into their Social Security. That's the single strongest thing that we could do to put Social Security on stronger footing.
And the thing that I think people don't understand about income inequality, I mean, we are now at a time of record income inequality. That basically means that there's less wages because of the cap, because
right.
The cap is so low, there's less wages that are actually subject to the Social Security tax. In fact, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we're somewhere about 7 or 8 percentage points less than what has been typically captured by the Social Security tax, because so much money is held in so few hands at the high end of the income spectrum.
That's correct. So in 1983, when the Greenspan Commission met, they set a target of capturing 90% of wages under the income cap. So not to get too wonky, but what that means is that a person only pays into Social Security up to $113,000. And then after that, they don't pay in at all into the Social Security on wages above that. So what you're looking at is, for somebody, for the vast majority of Americans, they're paying into Social Security on 100% of their wages. But for someone who's making, you know, for a Mitt Romney or a Bain Capital person who's making millions of dollars a year, they're only paying into a fraction of their income, right? So what you're talking about with the 90% and income inequality is as less and less of the wages in America have gone to middle-class workers, as more and more of the growth in this country has been hoovered up by the super wealthy, that is going into people's income that is above the cap. So if we were to actually lower income inequality and really create robust middle-class growth, that those wages would pay into the Social Security system, and they'd be there for the working-class folks, the middle-class folks, who are paying into the system their entire lives.
And we can also get there, in part, by simply getting rid of the cap. I mean, and when we talk about doing that, that 23-24% shortfall that is projected possibly 20 years out, all but goes away at that point, doesn't it?
It definitely does. So Senator Bernie Sanders has a bill right now that does just that. It just gets rid of the cap. It eliminates the cap, and it makes millionaires and billionaires pay the same rate as the rest of us.
So,
and in fact, with, you know, if we can do a couple of things, if we can get this country back to work, you know, and Americans want to work, and we want to create, there's this other thing, and I know you talk about it a lot. To me, it's actually painful to hear and read all of the news about this potential thing that's happening 20 years in the future, when right now we're looking at just devastating levels of unemployment. And if we looked at what was going on right now with unemployment, that would also strengthen the Social Security system. So scrapping the cap, eliminating the cap, or raising the cap, that's definitely a valid policy option. But to me, most importantly, we shouldn't even be having the discussion around Social Security right now, because it cannot, by law, contribute to the deficit. It has no borrowing authority, and it's a self-finance program with three streams of revenue. The media like to do this trick where they only count one of them, but it's financed through the payroll tax, your FICA contributions, interest on the $2.8 trillion in bonds that are in the trust fund, the same bonds that Goldman Sachs is holding, the same bonds that China is holding, and the U.S. The U.S. Treasury bonds are the safest investment. So the interest off those bonds, and then also taxes on high-income folks who are also receiving Social Security. And the system is still in surplus. So this year, again, the Social Security system brought in more money than is going out. So to me, while scrapping the cap, and I definitely support and the Strengthened Social Security Coalition gets behind Senator Sanders' bill to scrap the cap, I actually think we should be going further. If we're talking about scrapping the cap, we should be talking about expanding benefits as well.
Absolutely right about that. I mean, we've got just about 30 seconds here. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about that, because 401ks have been a huge disaster as an experiment for taking care of people's pensions. And this is all – we haven't even touched on the fact that Medicare, its solvency was pushed out 2 years, which just shows you how many different things can impact the success of these programs that have nothing to do with cutting these programs. Alex Lawson, StrengthenSocialSecurity.org. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. If you want to be a part of the program, 866-987-TOM, 866-987-TOM. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I want to hear from you. If you want to give a call, 866-987-TOM. Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman. Sam Cedar sitting in for Tom Hartman today. on loan from the Majority Report at majority.fm. We are packed today, folks. Still talking a little bit about the Social Security Trust Fund report that came out on Friday. That includes, of course, details of Medicare as well as Social Security. But basically, the news continues to be that Social Security is completely solvent until 2033, at which time, if we do absolutely nothing, and income disparity stays as it is, and wages continue to stagnate for the middle class, we will get only 76, 77% of our promised benefits at that time. And so I don't know about you, but when I think about something that is promised to me 20 years out and I can still get it, I'm fairly shocked that that's the case. I mean, there's not many other things in government, as we've seen, that are so predictable and so promised. And this is increasingly important. I mean, this is Alex Lawson made a good point when we just had him in the last segment. And that that point is that what we should be doing now is not talking about cutting benefits, as we've seen proposed in President Obama's budget. But instead, what we should be talking about is increasing Social Security benefits. And the reason is because the national experiment started 25, 30 years ago in a grand scale. The 401k, the defined contribution as opposed to defined benefit pension program, has been an utter failure. If this experiment was set up to ensure that Americans in their retirement have a retirement that is going to allow them some measure of dignity, some measure of financial security, then this has simply failed. There was a report that came out from the Center for Research at Retirement Research at Boston College earlier in the year. And it showed that the median household retirement account balance for 2010 for workers between 55 and 64 was just $120,000 a year. For people who are expecting to retire, hoping to retire at age 65, and living about 15 years longer, this is virtually nothing. On top of that, a third of households do not have any retirement account whatsoever. Zero. So they're going to be relying on a monthly benefit from Social Security that averages around, I don't know, $1,200, $1,300. And the reality is, we're all going to have to pay for this. We are not going to end up living in a society where we literally have a third of our seniors living in destitution. And so we're going to pay for it one way or another. And the question is, and as Alex mentioned before, we have, because of the wage stagnation of the middle class, because of the incredible amount of income inequality we have in this country, we have a system that was designed to capture 90% of wages earned in this country and is capturing only 81%. And he's, I think, more helpful that we can attack this problem by dealing with directly creating jobs for Americans. I hope we can. And dealing with other factors that contribute to wage inequality. But the reality is, we need to get rid of the cap. Not just for Social Security, because Social Security is almost one of the least the least important needs at this time. Because we can get rid of the wage cap at any time. But the fact is, we need to do it to create some parity in this country, because it is completely unhealthy for the economy in a myriad of ways to have this type of income disparity. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Wayne, listening in Granby, Massachusetts on WHMP. Wayne, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Sam. I appreciate you having me on. I was listening to you just before you took my call. I'm on Social Security disability, and my monthly income is exactly $1,361. So I'm right there where you're talking. What in the world did I do to make the Republicans all upset? Because all they want to do is cut my benefits. Without this, I'm going to starve to death.
Well, you're living high on the hog, according to them. Or I guess, despite the fact that you paid into this system for I don't know how many years, somehow you're just a taker, according to them.
Yeah, I'm on disability because of a nerve condition, which is not the Republicans' fault. But the other thing is, I don't qualify for any kind of medical insurance except in the fact that Massachusetts, I have the benefit of Romney Care, which, of course, is what Obama, you know, patterned a lot of what his health care plans were patterned after.
Absolutely.
And I'll tell you what, this is a great system.
Yeah, I mean, everything I've seen suggests that people in Massachusetts love that system. I mean, I would have liked to see the Affordable Care Act go further. I think in some instances the Affordable Care Act is going to be a bad deal for some people. But what is clear, and you're a perfect example of this, Wayne, is that more people are going to get coverage. And over time, if the law works the way that it's supposed to, and I've got to say the Republicans are doing everything they can to make sure that that doesn't happen. But over time, it should bring down costs. Now, and I appreciate the phone call, Wayne. We have seen, and this is part of the reason why we see Medicare adding 2 years of solvency, we've seen medical costs plateau, the rate of increase plateau. Some people suggest it's the Affordable Care Act. That may be part of it, but we're going to see more of that in the future. We got to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your calls, 866-987-TOM.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sam Cedar in for Tom Hartman today on Load from the Majority Report. I want to hear from you. Give us a call.
Jim Javinski here in for Tom Hartman on the news. You need to know this. 11 days after a deadly tornado hit the city of Moore, Oklahoma, 5 more tornadoes hit that state, killing at least 13 people and injuring more than 100 others. Among the lives lost were 3 Discovery Channel storm chasers, Carl Young and Tim and Paul Samaras. The storms hit just as roads and highways were jammed with rush hour traffic, leaving many people stuck in the path of the approaching twisters. At least one of the tornadoes was classified as an EF3 with winds up to 165 miles per hour. The storms also dumped softball-sized hail all over the state and over 8 inches of rain on the Oklahoma City region, causing flash floods and stranding many residents in malls, businesses, and other areas throughout the city. The neighboring state of Missouri was also hit by the massive EF3 twister, which damaged at least 170 homes. For years now, scientists have been warning us to expect massive storms fueled by warmer weather and higher levels of moisture in our atmosphere. While environmental experts will not link any one storm directly to global warming, they agree that these super hurricanes, devastating floods, and monster tornadoes are the undeniable result of climate change. Scientists warn that if we continue to pump more and more carbon pollution into our atmosphere, these storms will continue to grow in power and in frequency. This is the new normal, and without immediate change, it will get even worse. In screwed news, U.S. District Court Judge Suzel Ilston has ordered Google to comply with the FBI-issued national security letters and violate our privacy. Back in March, that same judge ruled that these so-called national security letters were unconstitutional. Yet only 2 months later, Judge Ilston ruled in favor of the FBI and ordered Google to hand over user information. The case in March was brought by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which challenged the FBI's demand that national security letter recipients refrain from notifying anyone, including customers, about the requests for private information. Judge Ilston ruled that the FBI's demand was a violation of free speech rights, and thus the letters were unconstitutional. In the more recent case, Google was challenging 19 NSA letters, but after reviewing sworn statements from FBI officials, the judge said she was satisfied that the letters were issued properly. Many Americans are concerned about privacy violations by our government. They are hoping that Google will appeal this ruling and fight for our right to privacy. In the best of the rest of the news, people in the EU have said no to GMOs. For the third year in a row, Monsanto will not apply for approval to sell genetically modified seeds in Europe. That's because of low demand from farmers and a strong public opposition. A company spokeswoman said, quote, "As long as there's not enough demand from farmers for these products and the public at large doesn't accept the technology, it makes no sense to fight against windmills," end quote. Currently, 8 European Union nations have banned Monsanto's genetically modified corn and other crops. Only Portugal, Spain, and a few Eastern European countries allow GMO corn. Public protest against the crops continues throughout the EU. Monsanto's announcement comes just a few months after another GMO producer, BASF, gave up on its approval to sell genetically modified potatoes in Europe because of strong opposition. The people of the EU have maintained a united front against GMO producers, and their efforts are proving that organized people can and will defeat organized money. Republicans in Wisconsin want the right to peek into your bank account when you're out of work. A new bill moving quickly through that state's legislature, which would require banks doing business with the state to disclose the personal financial information of people who may owe money to the unemployment system. This proposed law would allow officials to freeze bank accounts and recover overpaid unemployment funds, even when those overpayments were made because of government error. The bill also proposes other changes to Wisconsin's unemployment system, including cutting benefits on those completing vocational training and denying benefits to someone who refuses a job offer, even if that job only pays minimum wage. Governor Scott Walker and his Republican cronies have waged economic war on unions and workers, and now it appears they're going after the unemployed. Will the people of Wisconsin take a stand to protect those who can't afford to protect themselves? And finally, the biblical story of Noah's Ark has raised questions, even for the most devout believers. If you've ever wondered how Noah found two of every animal, or how it is that he managed to fit them on the boat, the creators of Kentucky's Creation Museum want millions in tax breaks to help answer your questions. That's right, they've designed a $150 million theme park called the Ark Encounter, and they're asking Kentucky taxpayers to foot $37 million of the bill. The park would include a 500-foot-long wooden ark and other Old Testament attractions like a Tower of Babel and a 10 Plagues ride. The required permits won't be ready until November. So it appears it will take more than 40 days and 40 nights to construct this Old Testament theme park. That's the way it is today, Monday, June 3rd, 2013. I'm Jim Javinski, sitting in for Tom Hartman here on the news.
We are back, Sam Cedar. Filling in for the great Tom Hartman. I am on loan from my daily show, The Majority Report, and we're talking about Social Security. The trustees came out with their report on Friday. Social Security doing quite well. If anybody else has a suggestion to me that what we can count on 20 years from now at 100% benefits, I'd like to hear it. And even, again, if we do nothing at all, the worst-case scenario we have is receiving only 77% of our benefits. So what the question that we have to ask is, why do we constantly hear the solution to the potential of cuts in the future to Social Security benefits is to cut those benefits now? It's simply absurd, and there's obviously an agenda there, and it's It's not to shrink the deficit. We know that Social Security by law does not contribute to the deficit. We also know that the deficit has shrunk at a rate unparalleled in the past almost 70 years. The deficit is half of, or projected to be half of, what it was when President Obama came to office. And I'm not cheerleading this. This is exactly the opposite of what we should be doing at a time where we have the private sector of the economy is unable to produce jobs. What we need to be doing is taking advantage of some of the lowest borrowing rates that the country has had in decades and borrow that money to invest in the future. It is almost irresponsible. In fact, I would say it is irresponsible for this government, which can borrow money at a rate that after 10 years is almost a net gain for them, if you include the inflation. But let's just call it at parity for virtually 0% interest. It's the height of irresponsibility when you have millions of Americans out of work, when you have bridges falling down around the country, where you have a transportation infrastructure like trains that is subpar, that we don't have any type of national standard for high-speed internet, when we need to create better education systems and outcomes, where we could use daycare. Universal access to daycare in this country, it is irresponsible for the government not to borrow money at such favorable interest rates, because we know the multiplier effect of government spending. Not just in terms of the way that it helps the economy now, but also in terms of the payoff from investments down the road. Let's go to the phones. Diane is calling from Santa Clara County in California, watching on Free Speech. Welcome to the program, Diane.
Hi, I love your energy.
Well, I'm glad. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, I wanted to tell you that about Social Security, it's amazing. My friend works at a senior center, and he knows, he and I both know, that some of the people there only have one meal a day. Mm. And so when Rachel Maddox, and I like her, but when some people talk about there's going to be a devastation, there already is.
I couldn't agree with you more, Diane. And, you know, the notion that somehow, as I think it was former Senator Simpson of Simpson Bowles fame, the notion that we have a country, and pardon my French, but I'm quoting him, of teat suckers, that the old are greedy in this country is simply absurd. And in many respects, the reason why a guy like Senator Simpson, who was almost bequeathed his Senate position back in the day, is out there earning $40,000 a speaking engagement to talk about how greedy seniors are, is because he doesn't want to talk about the reality that to the extent that we have greedy people in this country, it is a function of class distinction. It is a function of the 7% who have seen something like 93% of all wealth that's been created in the last 3 years. Those are the people who cry like the sky is falling when their tax rate gets raised 3% because the original Bush tax cut sunsetted. Those are the people who are greedy in this country.
I know, and sometimes I can't even talk to my brother, who's actually retired a sheriff. He actually voted for Bush. And, I mean, I don't tell him what I really think. But one of the things I wanted to tell you is I'm staying with a friend temporarily in Santa Clara County. There are 7,000 homeless people
yes.
in Santa Clara County, you know, in Silicon Valley. And, Sam, get this, 40 encampments.
Wow.
This is, you know, and I'm really angry at, you know, like I know when people were worshiping Steve Jobs, well, you know, it's amazing.
I couldn't agree more, Diane. I mean, there is massive public works to be done at this point, and the idea of cutting benefits to folks at a time when we need it is the last thing we need to see. I appreciate the phone call. Let's go to Frank. Let's go to James, listening in Chicago, Illinois, on WCPT. James, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. You seem like a smart guy.
Thank you.
I've seen you before. I've heard you, and you're pretty on the money all the time. What I have to tell you is it's more to a solution side, okay, to the problem. First of all, you know, Social Security was an expansion to the economy. Before Social Security, people just got old and died early and they weren't really contributing back into the economy because they had no money to contribute back into the economy with. They weren't going down buying new cars or shopping at anywhere. You know, they were just, you know, living, you know, hoping to have, you know,
indeed,
over their head and keep their drugs,
yep,
you know, keep their health. You know, so it expanded with an expansion. You know, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing in the auto industry because part of that is supported by people having money, older people going into those dealerships and spending money.
Of course. Of course. I mean, there's no the vast majority of Social Security recipients put that money back into the economy. There's no reason for them to save it. And in many instances, like we just heard, there's no capacity or ability to save because that's their full income.
Sure, but it's reciprocal. It's reciprocal back to the taxpayer. He paid in, he gets it back, you know,
yes,
and it goes back into the economy. So it reciprocates around. It's circular. We can do that to create jobs, to support Social Security and Medicare, and support our infrastructure. We can do that by creating a manufacturing base by using our tax money, say $2,000-$3,000 for people that own a house, because there's three basic human necessities since man crawled out from underneath the rock or out of the Garden of Eden, however you believe. That's food, clothing, and shelter. You eat the food, it's gone. You wear the clothes, they wear out, you throw them away. The only thing that's generational out of three basic human necessities is a shelter.
Right.
Banks have known that forever.
So what are you suggesting, James? We got to be quick. I want to move on here. But
just,
what?
Home improvement maintenance. You can only build new homes for so long. It's simply going to keep pace with the existing ones you've already built. So if you take $2,000 or $3,000, that man that has a job, he's fortunate enough to have a job. He's not retired. He's not disabled yet. He's still paying into the system. He's owned a home for 2 years. Now the IRS could say, "Hey, look, we did your itemized deductions. We took your money, supported the military, the roads, the bridges, everything that makes this country a better place to work, live, and do business." And
James, you know, to a certain extent, I mean, I think there is literally no program that involves government spending that is in any way spent on things that we're going to need in the future that will not help the economy at this point. I mean, I think you'd be very hard-pressed to see a dollar spent by the government that is not going to help the economy. What you're talking about in many respects is the home mortgage deduction. We already give homeowners a big break. I mean, the government should be literally hiring people to do what needs to be done around the country. And instead, what we're seeing is a sequester, which we are already starting to feel the impacts of across the country, particularly if you're someone who is relying on Meals on Wheels, or if you're relying on Head Start for your kids, or if you are waiting in lines for planes, but because that involved wealthier people, we see that fixed immediately. But we see all sorts of needs around the country, and we know the sequester is going to get far worse next year when we see 25% cuts to the EPA budget, 25% cuts to the Department of Labor budget, when we start to see less food inspectors. And we had a food inspector scare this year because of the sequester. So this is all going to get worse, both in terms of government services, but we're also seeing the drag it has on the economy. When the private sector is not functioning because there is a lack of demand, we need government spending. The less government spending we have, the more of a drag that absence of spending is on our economy. That's simply basic economics. And so we need more of it. And so the idea of cutting Social Security now is a joke. We need to expand it. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
All right, Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman, 866-987-TOM. Take your calls in a minute. Back, Sam Cedar, filling in for Tom Hartman today. I'm on loan from the Majority Report at majority.fm, streaming live every day, 12 noon Eastern. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Eric Beiler. He is a filmmaker and activist, co-founder of the Coffee Party USA, and he's on the ground in North Carolina following the protests, the rolling protests that have been going on the past couple of Mondays and Mondays into the future. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, Eric, tell me what is going on there. Why are you in North Carolina right now?
Well, I'm talking to you from outside the Martin Street Baptist Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. There are hundreds and hundreds of people inside right now being instructed on civil disobedience. They are planning to enter the chambers of the General Assembly about 5 o'clock, and I've actually covered this 4 times before. They sing empowerment songs that we associate with the civil rights movement, and those people who do not obey the police, who declare the assembly unlawful pretty much as soon as they get there, are arrested. And then they will be put on buses. But the cool thing is that the protesters have figured out where the buses are loaded. And so the people get this incredible send-off as they get on the bus. There's, today is by a magnitude of 3, I'd say, at least larger than at least the church part of the protest in the previous week. It's grown every week. So I have no idea what's going to happen when we get to the General Assembly, but based on Facebook rumblings and based on the size of the crowd that's just filled up the balcony and every place you could possibly sit in this church, I think it's going to be quite a protest.
All right. No, I want to back up a moment. So we have these series of Monday protests. What is going on in North Carolina that is activating so many people?
Well, my partner, Annabelle Park, said essentially what we're seeing in North Carolina is an experiment to see what would have happened if Mitt Romney had won and there was a Republican supermajority in Congress. And so it is essentially an agenda that comes from the group ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. I'm sure you're aware it's basically a corporate or ruling class agenda. And the laws that they are passing essentially redistribute wealth from poor people up to rich people. For instance, they're adding sales taxes. They're taking away tax credits, like earned income tax credits, and at the same time giving tax cuts that affect really only 23 wealthy families. 23 wealthy families are impacted by the tax break. And then you're talking about hundreds of thousands, even millions of people who are affected by the tax increases. And then you also have education. They're trying to get through a law that allows public funds to go to private academies. They feel that this will lead to even deeper segregation of the schools than they have now, and that people who are stuck in the public schools will be basically abandoned to a really poor education. Economists are concerned that this means that with poorly educated workers, it means that the only business that will come to North Carolina will be businesses that only want cheap labor, but they're not really the type of businesses that grow economies. And then, of course, there's the civil rights issues with the voting, basically voting restrictions they're trying to hammer through. not just the voter ID that other states have, which is problematic in itself because people who want to continue voting but don't drive cars or were born a long time ago and don't have birth certificates in hospitals because they were born with midwives at home, those people are going to have a harder time getting to the polls. But it's not just that. They also are concerned about college students voting too much, and so they want to push through a law that penalizes the parents of college students who vote in the towns where they go to college by taking away their ability to claim them on their state income tax form as a dependent. They also want to do away with
Eric. Let's stop you here because you know the stories that are coming out of North Carolina in terms of what, and this is a situation people have to understand. We have a Republican governor, we have a Republican state senate, we have a Republican state legislature through and through here. This is the speed and the fervor in which they are creating essentially some type of strange dystopia, like where they want to fire all the state's environmental regulators. They want to pretend that global warming doesn't exist. They want to disenfranchise voters. Like you say, they want to defund any programs that's helping anyone. It is made. Now, I know this started with a Reverend William Barber. Tell us a little bit about him and just how broad this coalition is that that seems to be dealing with this.
Yeah, that's one of the most beautiful things about it. We've interviewed hundreds of people, and it is really that rainbow coalition. It's that 21st century America that we are becoming. It's the America that ushered in Barack Obama to the White House in 2008. And a lot of political scientists and reporters are saying that the 2008 election in which Obama actually won North Carolina really put the fright into Republican political, not just the politicians, but the people who depend on them for the policies that they need to, maximize their profit. And so these laws are basically trying to prevent the inevitable demographic shift. It's going to happen in the populace for sure, but if they can limit the degree to which it happens in the electorate, then they can hold on to power a little bit longer. And William Barber is a PhD and a reverend. He has a church that's called the Greenleaf Baptist. It's a Pentecostal church. He's also the head of the NAACP of North Carolina. And a lot of people compare him to Martin Luther King. And if you've been in the room when he speaks, it's not an exaggeration. And Annabelle and I, the film we're making is called Story of America. If you go to storyofamerica.org, you'll see a number of videos. Many of them include Reverend Barber. One of them is just an entire speech from beginning to end that we shot a few weeks ago.
I got to tell you, Eric, people from the photographs that I have seen of the crowds that have been there, not just this week, but in the weeks past, it is incredibly impressive. So today may be equally impressive. Check out Eric's site there so that you can see those videos. Eric, thanks so much for joining us. We've got to take a break. And when we come back in the next hour, we're going to be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It is very scary stuff.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman. I'm on loan from my daily program, The Majority Report, heard via the internet anyways at majority.fm or majorityreportradio.com. On the phone, I want to welcome to the program Melinda St. Louis. She is the International Campaigns Director for Public Citizens Global Trade Watch to talk about, in particular, a couple of trade deals that have not been reported on very much in the news, and that is certainly by design. We're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then another deal with the EU, which I don't even know the name of at this point. It's gotten so little coverage. Welcome to the program, Melinda.
Thank you for having me.
So, Melinda, I want to read for you a quote from Chile's former lead negotiator of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I want to get your reaction to it because I think this is very telling. He just resigned a couple of weeks ago, and he wrote in his resignation, "It's critical to reject the imposition of a model designed according to realities of high-income countries, which are very different from the other participating countries. Now, at that point, when I read something like that, I think he's going to say, we're not going to have the opportunity to build our economy as the richest countries can. Chile maybe being a mid-level, if you will, in terms of their economy. But no, he goes on to say, it will restrict our development options in health and education, in biological and cultural diversity, and in the design of public policies and the transformation of our economies. And he also says that this could create all sorts of civil unrest because a government would not be working to increase the prosperity and well-being of our countries. What is in the TPP that this guy is so concerned about?
Well, that's a very good question. The TPP is being touted as a trade agreement, and in fact, it is a deal that's being negotiated behind closed doors. It's in the third year of very strong negotiations. There have been 17 rounds of negotiations already, and there are only 5 of 29 chapters that we know of that actually have anything to do with traditional trade matters, such as tariffs on goods. The rest of it is actually a lot of chapters that touch on all of the things that the chief negotiator for Chile mentioned. There's a chapter on intellectual property. Well, what does that mean? That refers to actually the price of medicine for developing countries and in developed countries like the United States. There are large pharmaceutical companies that are trying to write new rules on patents, how long they can have monopolies on new drugs, or even drugs that are already in existence. There are elements of copyright in this intellectual property chapter. That what that actually will impact is the freedom to on the internet for users to be able to share information and to be able to use the internet in the way that people are becoming accustomed. There are rules in that are being negotiated that would actually encourage offshoring of corporations to go to other jurisdictions and be able to sue for cash compensation if there are laws that they don't think allow them to get the profits that they're hoping to achieve. So in that, and
now, Melinda, wait a second. I want to stop you there. And if you could, if you're on speakerphone, it would be great if you could just get off that for a second. But let me see if I can characterize that aspect that a corporation can actually say, and we see a dynamic like this in the context of Canada right now. A corporation could say, we wanted to enter into your market, being another country. We had estimates and projections of profits at X. However, you have a labor regulation, or you have an environmental regulation, or you have a consumer safety regulation that inhibits our ability to maximize our profits. They can then sue that country for those profits, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that's adjudicated not by any type of court, but by a tribunal that consists of corporate trade lawyers basically on sabbatical from their corporate jobs, and they just rotate through. Do I have that right?
Unfortunately, you do have that right. And in fact, they're not even on sabbatical from their corporate jobs. One day they can actually be representing a corporation suing a government. The next day, the tribunal judging these types of cases. And this is through a very extreme provision in these trade agreements that's being replicated in the TPP that we have seen through leaked documents that gives extreme investor privileges. Now, these are privileges that corporations, foreign corporations, have over domestic corporations. If you are a U.S. business and there is an environmental measure that is put into place and it affects your profits, you can sue through our domestic court systems to see what is possible for you to obtain. If you're a foreign investor, you can bypass our courts and you can go directly to these extra national tribunals that, again, there are 3 corporate lawyers that decide these cases. And this is not hypothetical. Already there have been $3.5 billion in taxpayer money from countries that have had to pay corporations just under U.S. trade and investment treaties, and
these are coming out of like the WTO, NAFTA and GATT. Is that basically
under NAFTA, under CAFTA, which is the Central America Free Trade Agreement, the U.S. Peru Free Trade Agreement, and so forth. And what we're opening ourselves up to, if we include these extreme provisions in the TPP, is actually corporations from countries like Japan who are joining. And if we include this in this U.S.-European Union free trade agreement that you mentioned, we're actually opening up all the European corporations that are part of in the United States to be able to sue not just national level laws, but local laws, state laws. If you ban a toxic chemical, for example, you can be sued. If you put a regulation on mining, if there's been contamination of the water supply, you can have to pay taxpayer funds of compensation to the polluters in the case of these provisions. And we have seen leaked documents that say that this is in the TPP. They want to expand this
to
now 12 countries in the Pacific Rim.
Melinda, let me stop you here because we don't have too much time. And I want to just, you know, I think people need to really understand this from a conceptual level. We have regulations, or other countries have regulations, laws, environmental regulations, consumer safety regulations, labor regulations. And these things, as anemic as sometimes they are, they're a reflection, at the very least, of our political process, right? I mean, some people push for these laws, corporations push back. These are all superseded by essentially a code that is developed by corporations that supersedes the sovereignty of any country that's involved here.
Absolutely. And in the TPP context, there are 600 cleared advisors who are helping to write these rules. Almost all of them are corporate lobbyists and representatives of the largest corporations. The public, even U.S. members of Congress, have been locked out. They have not been able to see this text. And yet, what we're seeing is that the rules are being written by the corporations, and it is really an end run around our democratic process to sneak in these types of extreme rules that they aren't able to get through our democratic process.
All right, folks need to go to citizen.org/trade. We have a link up on Tom Hartman's site. We'll put one up on majority.fm as well, because the big fight is about fast track, which means that essentially, the Senate will just sign off on this, rubber stamp it. So we've got to fight the imposition of fast track in the Senate. Melinda St. Louis, thanks so much for your time today. Really scary stuff. People should check out your site for more information.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman today. Give me a call, 866-987-TOM, T-H-O-M. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman for the day. I'm on loan from the Majority Report. You can check it out at majorityreportradio.com. We're streaming live every day at 12 noon. Let's go back to the phones. Dave calling from AM 760 in Denver. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Hey, Sam. Thank you very much. I basically couldn't agree with you guys anymore about what's going on with these trade deals. And really, when you look at it from the perspective of 1992, when basically Ross of the Perot said, you hear that sucking sound? Because what we're doing is we're turning over not only our jobs, but our national sovereignty to these corporations. And that's absolutely insane and not in our best interest.
I couldn't agree with you more. That is the reality. I mean, I'm not sure that the TPP is going to impact jobs in the way that NAFTA did. And, of course, we know that uh, the the anemic job growth that took place in Mexico because of NAFTA ended up, most of those jobs ended up going to China eventually. But what it did effectively do was it created a dynamic where an American-produced ear of corn cost half the price of a Mexican-produced ear of corn. And so it essentially kicked tens of thousands of campesinos off their land because they can no longer be supported.
Absolutely.
They came to the cities. They couldn't find jobs. And, of course, they need to go. They came up to the United States because they needed to feed their families. And who can blame them? I think what we're seeing with the TPP, to the extent that we even know what's in it, is significantly worse. And so the most important thing we can do at this point is really stop Fast Track, because that is the most that is the process by which this TPP will continue and this EU deal. I mean, you know, presumably we already have trade deals with the EU that are fairly free, in quotations. So the only thing that's going to ensure that these type of provisions get the scrutiny they deserve is if Fast Track is denied for these trade deals. And you know that is the agenda, to make sure these trade deals do not get the proper amount of scrutiny. That's why they're being negotiated in such secrecy. And when Chile's lead negotiator drops out and says this could cause massive problems in any country but the richest, and that essentially is code for those that allow the corporations to run roughshod over their regulations, regulatory structure, we've got to run for the hills. And he resigned rather than to continue going down this road. Let's go back to the phones. Jerry, WWRL in Long Island, New York. Jerry, I think it's been a long time since I spoke to you. How you doing?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Long time no speak to you. It's good to speak to you again. Yeah, before I get to Social Security, let me just say in passing that this TPP, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, is just further evidence of how we're turning more and more into a corporatocracy. And in my opinion, it's just so sad that we have a Democratic president like President Obama helping to move us in that direction.
Indeed.
But with respect to Social Security, now, and before I get to the issue of getting rid of the caps on Social Security, on caps on the income subject to a Social Security tax, you asked a question related to Social Security about why the cuts are even being proposed. Well, I think it's pretty obvious that the cuts are intended, in my opinion, to weaken and sabotage programs like Social Security and others by people who want to privatize these programs. And what I find so sad and what angers me is that both in Florida and even in the supposedly liberal state of New York where I am, with a Democratic governor like Andrew Cuomo, you've had successful attempts made to privatize Medicaid by pushing its beneficiaries into private managed care plans as an alternative to Medicaid. And we know these managed care plans, they just save money by denying treatment and care. And yet there's been such a lack of public outcry and very little public attention given to this issue. But as far as Social Security and raising the caps, I agree with you. Or getting rid of the caps, I agree with you that we need to get rid of the cap on income subject to the Social Security tax, and I even have a proposal. Because I think what we did instead of continuing the caps the way they are, where only income up to $113,000 is subject to a Social Security tax, and income beyond that is completely free of any Social Security taxes whatsoever, I think instead we should place a Social Security tax on all of a person's income from whatever source derived, including from investment income,
right,
the kind that Mitt Romney has and various other people have on Wall Street. And if we made it, we could lower the Social Security payroll tax from 6.2% to 4.2%, tax everybody's income, if it's $1 million, $1 billion, and even if they derive it from investment income, if we made that subject to a tax of 4.2%, that's what we could do. We could take the Social Security.
Right. And I know, now, Jerry, let me summarize here because we don't have too much time, and I appreciate your suggesting this. And I think, you know, I mean, to a certain extent, look, the point is, And it was great to hear from you, Jerry. But the point is here is that we have a need to expand Social Security benefits. And the reason why we're seeing instead proposal to cut Social Security benefits is a function of the fact that the income disparity we have been experiencing in this country has gone hand in hand with a political inequality as well. There are plenty of studies out there. Check out Gillen's and Bartels from Princeton and other places who have basically shown that the policy preferences of the rich, whenever there's any type of dispute as to a policy preference, the policy preferences of the rich win out regardless of who is in office. So, you know, Jerry's got a great proposal where capital gains or investment gains that are not productive to society should be taxed like everything else is taxed. Why should we value money over work? We won't see any of that until we see some genuine political change in this country. And that, of course, is up to you. We got to take a break. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Sam Seder filling in for Tom Hartman all the rest of today. Join me. Sam Seder in for Tom Hartman. Our number is 866-987-TOM. But with me now is Aviva Shen. She is a general reporter from thinkprogress.org and here to talk to me about what's happening with Monsanto. Aviva, my understanding is that Monsanto is having some problems with their GMO products in Europe. What do they know that we don't know?
Well, it's not clear. People who aren't in the U.S. have been a lot more careful about GMOs, a lot more suspicious about importing them. Wheat in particular, which I think is the big controversy right now, has been especially controversial because people actually eat it directly. You know, a lot of countries will import GMO corn because it goes into, you know, livestock feed or soy, but wheat for some reason is kind of considered special. But in the U.S. it's been, you know, we've been pretty much taken over by GMOs because we don't have the same kinds of standards, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating to me because it seems to me there's a couple of issues here. And I'm someone who at least perceives himself to be well-rooted in science. And I think the one thing that is clear about GMO, we don't know really, in terms of when you ingest this stuff, we don't really know that it's necessarily bad for you.
Right.
We don't necessarily know that it's good for you. We certainly know that you know, different strains of wheat or whatever product exist just by natural processes. But the problem is that A, we don't necessarily know, and B, it also, we don't know, more importantly, at least in my mind, what it does to the ecosystem, do we?
Right. That's exactly right. There's not really any compelling evidence that GMOs are bad for your health directly in terms of just ingesting them. But, you know, what is bad is that you have one company that's controlling most of the American food supply and a lot of the global food supply at this point. And that's killing food diversity, and lack of food diversity is bad for health. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for the environment. And, you know, even people who would prefer to avoid GMOs really can't anymore. Organic seeds are going extinct pretty quickly. I think there was a study that showed that about half of all organic seeds in the U.S. actually have some GMO material. So it's not really about health dangers, but more about there's just a lack of choice at this point.
And you know, if the issue is essentially sustainability. I mean, we have seen different Monsanto-produced products mm-hmm. that ostensibly, and well, maybe you should just lay out what it is supposedly that we get from GMO products.
Well, I think their argument is that when GMOs first started being developed in the 90s, they argued that it was going to reduce pesticide use because they could develop these pesticide-resistant crops that would let farmers use less pesticides on them. But that turned out, you know, recent studies over the past 10 years that are now coming out are showing that that's actually completely false. It's actually breeding these super insects and super weeds that can withstand the pesticides. And so farmers are actually they're having to put in more and more and more pesticides and herbicides on the plants. And of course, those herbicides are owned by Monsanto, so they're still making a huge profit off of it. But it's not very good for our actual agricultural system, and it's definitely not sustainable.
All right, so now the reason why these bugs are essentially evolving to withstand this is because we have not just a sort of a monoculture when it comes to the crops, but a monoculture in when it comes in terms to the herbicides and pesticides, right? Because you need a specific pesticide or herbicide formulation that plays nicely with the specific crops, right? And so the bugs evolve, it seems to me, it basically provides a pathway for the bugs to evolve into these sort of super bugs.
Right, exactly. And you have huge swaths of the Midwest and, you know, the kind of bread belt of America where there are just like these huge fields of the same kind of corn or the same kind of soy, and people are using the same kinds of pesticides on them. And so it's very, very easy for these kinds of insects and weeds to flourish because it's just so easy for them to dominate these very monotone kind of areas.
So Aviva, if the idea, or at least one of the things that was sold to the world as a benefit of GMOs were that it was going to require a decrease, or it was going to compel a decrease in the use of herbicides and pesticides, and that didn't seem to work out so well.
Right.
Were there other claims? I mean, shouldn't we now, if Monsanto and the GMOs if their promises had rung true, shouldn't we now be living in a heyday of incredibly cheap food? I mean, incredibly cheap wheat and corn and whatnot. And shouldn't the future be so bright that those millions who are protesting against these GMOs in Europe would be considered ridiculous because they're shooting off, they're cutting off their nose to spite their face?
Right. Well, you know, they have also billed GMOs as the solution to the global food crisis. But in reality, farmers don't really want that solution because it means that they're basically indebted to Monsanto for every single growing season as soon as they agree to sign Monsanto's patent agreement. And the result of these patent agreements is that farmers have to pay for their seeds. They're not allowed to save their seeds or they'll get sued, which Monsanto does very aggressively. And saving seeds has been a very traditional agricultural practice for hundreds of years. And the result of this, because Monsanto is so aggressive about their patent protections, is that there hasn't been much innovation by other firms because there's just no point. And so I think there have been a few studies that have shown that the aggressive patent protection has actually spiked seed prices, and it's also stifled innovation. So there's pretty much no competition and much less crop variety.
Well, and now, I mean, has the rise of GMO, has it led to the idea that we can now grow wheat anywhere, or the idea, you know, the corn is ubiquitous? I mean, you know, I mean, my point is there a change between post and pre-GMO when we have at least a couple of crops now that seem to be overwhelmingly GMO in this country? Is there been a radical change in the availability of these crops, in the price reduction of these crops? Because I just want to know if there's any benefits, because it seems to me quite obvious that down the road, we don't know what the implications are on the specific ecologies that we're dealing with. And what we also know is that, as you've stated, we have limited the flexibility of farmers to adapt to the change that they're undoubtedly experiencing because of global climate change.
Right.
So, I mean, if I don't have the flexibility as a farmer to deal with the fact that I am now on land that used to be well-watered, it is not very well-watered, or land that is significantly wetter because of this, or that I get hail early earlier in the season, or whatever it is, I don't have the flexibility to deal with the changes in the weather in the same way that I used to, because my ability to have a variety of seeds is completely limited. But are we seeing any of the wonderful benefits of these crops? I'm trying to be fair fair-minded about this.
Well, I guess it depends what you consider a benefit. Obviously, Monsanto has profited a lot. And also, because of the cheap corn that's been available, although, as I said, the corn prices are now spiking, largely because there's no competition, you're able to have, you know, cheaper feed for livestock, which has resulted in a lot of factory farms. You're able to have a lot more processed food for cheaper because it's much cheaper to buy corn and turn that into high fructose corn syrup than it ever has been before. So I guess in terms of, you know, more Doritos for everyone, they've...
But even then, I mean, Aviva, can we really say, I mean, I don't know. I mean, and there very well could be data out there to support this. Yeah. But I would imagine if Monsanto was sitting on a pile of data that showed that, you know, and I agree with you from a health perspective, I don't think cheaper corn is the answer. But you know, taking it from their perspective, I imagine if there was a lot of data out there that shows that Monsanto's products are directly responsible for a reduction in the prices of these commodities, that we would hear a lot about it, because, you know, we've been subsidizing corn for 40 years in this country.
Right.
And so it's been a part of our, you know, we've been paying for this cheap corn. It's not an invention of the invention of GMOs that has provided it. I just wonder if there's data out there that's showing that anybody but Monsanto is benefiting from this.
I don't know. I think it's hard to say. Crop subsidies have been around for a long time, but I think that the fact that they have made it much easier to produce this kind of corn, although now there are obviously consequences for that in terms of the evolved pests, I think that was probably a big, you know, shaper of American agriculture, at least in the past 10 years or so.
Well, we do know that recently the Senate passed the Monsanto Protection Act, mm-hmm. which would shield the company from lawsuits over health risks related to genetically modified seeds. Now,
yeah.
I got to imagine, and we only have about 30 seconds here, I got to imagine that Monsanto wanted this passed, and it wasn't because they were so confident about their the health risks of their products, but who knows. Aviva Shen, I appreciate your talking to us about this. We will it's something that people have got to pay attention to.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, we'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Sam Cedar filling in for the great Tom Hartman on loan from the Majority Report at MajorityReportRadio.com. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman. I'm on loan from the Majority Report, heard daily at MajorityReportRadio.com. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Victoria Jones of Talk Radio News. How are you, Victoria?
I'm very well, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm up here in New York sweating. I imagine you're not so cool in Washington, D.C. What is happening in the news down there?
A great deal, as a matter of fact.
I can imagine.
Yes, it's one of those days. The Army began its court-martial of PFC Bradley Manning today, arguing that the former intelligence analyst charged with espionage knew the information could fall into enemy hands when he leaked 700,000 classified documents to WikiLeaks. During opening statements, prosecutors said that they've got evidence that Osama bin Laden asked for these WikiLeaks files after they were released, and they also say the information was found on computers inside his Pakistan compound when it was raided by Navy SEALs a couple of years ago.
Now, Victoria, now I've covered this Bradley Manning case quite a bit on my program, on my Daily Show. I know Tom has talked about it quite a bit, too. There's two things that are stunning about this. One is the precedent that is being set that any time a leaker gives to the press, they must know that it's going to be published in some way, whether it's the Pentagon Papers or anything else at this point. And we have never seen the Espionage Act used in that fashion. It is one thing to say this guy was guilty of leaking. He has pled to as much. But the idea that this could be espionage is pretty stunning. And then the other question I have, which is somewhat related, is do we know what else that Osama bin Laden downloaded from his computer? Because I get to imagine it's just about every article that's been written about the United States over the course of decades of years.
Well, I think that's a very valid point and exactly right. He downloaded a great deal of information, I'm sure, and I imagine those people are not about to go on trial.
Right. I mean, of course not. I mean, the guy wants to get a sense of what our culture is. If I recall correctly, over the years, he's commented on a myriad of topics that he clearly got from the newspaper, so that in and of itself shouldn't be evidence of anything. But that trial begins today, like you say. What else is happening in D.C.? I imagine some of the faux and perhaps real scandals continue.
Yes, some of them do continue. The IRS mess continues, and there is a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing going on this afternoon. The new IRS acting commissioner, Danny Werfel, is testifying, and he's sort of a wonky kind of guy, comes from the Office of Management and Budget, doesn't seem to have a stain on his record, has a reputation for cutting government spending, things like that, and has made it very clear that he's interested in getting to the bottom of things and putting things right at the IRS. And that's basically what he's been saying to the members of that committee. It's difficult for them to go after him because he's only been on the job 2 to 3 weeks and clearly wasn't there when it happened. However, there are three hearings this week. There's a very interesting Ways and Means hearing tomorrow at which six Tea Party groups will testify, and they will talk about the abuse that they say they received from the IRS when they received this extra targeting. Now, one of them is particularly interesting because it's the Wetumpka Tea Party from Alabama. And that is a group that was one of the subjects of a New York Times story about just over a week ago where it talked about how some of these groups actually did seem to engage in political activity.
Yeah, I mean, of course. And I'm also curious, have we even heard of, I mean, we know that the Tea Party, to the extent that any Tea Party groups were, and targeted seems to be the wrong word, were sort of culled for extra review in the context of a review process. But we also know that there was tons of other groups. I mean, do we know those figures? In other words, are we going to also hear from 5 or 10 or 15 other groups during that committee hearing that represent the full scope and proportion of who received extra scrutiny when they applied for this tax-exempt secret donor exemption?
No, we're not. We're only going to hear from 6 Tea Party type of groups during this hearing. This is a Republican-led committee. So this is very much a hearing designed to elicit a particular type of response.
Right.
And one of the things that does seem to be missing from the information that's trickling out about all this is who were the other groups. We hear dribs and drabs about who some of these other groups were, but we really haven't had a full accounting yet.
Yeah, this whole thing just basically sounds like a way to intimidate the IRS. I don't even think, I mean, is there a sense that this is, are there Republicans on the Hill who think this is going to be this golden chalice? Are they going to be able to get the impeachment that they have desired for this president like they do every Democratic president?
Oh, I think there are House members who think that's a possibility and who are hoping for that. They're deposing employees of the IRS last week and this week, and hoping that through questioning of them that things will lead to it originating out of the IRS Washington office, and that out of that they can find out that it originated out of the White House. But so far, we don't know that they found anything like that, and I think if Daryl Issa had had anything yesterday, he would have brought it out on the Sunday shows, and he didn't.
I think what's stunning to me, and we just have a minute left here, Victoria, but is the media still sort of biting on this stuff? I mean, didn't they get burned quite badly with the whole Benghazi thing? Haven't they learned their lesson yet that when we see this partial disclosure from these Republicans that we can't trust it?
When Daryl Issa called White House spokesman Jay Carney a paid liar, the press inhaled a breath and said, whoa, this thing's getting out of control.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Well, Victoria Jones, I have to say I'm glad it's you and not me in Washington, D.C. right now. But I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a short couple of minutes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sam Seder filling in for Tom Hartman on loan from the Majority Report. And on the phone, I want to welcome to the program Julie Samuels. She is a staff attorney, and this is actually her title, the Mark Cuban Chair to Eliminate Stupid Patents from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Julie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Now, Julie, I have to say that I became introduced to this topic of patent trolls in an extremely unfortunate way. As you know, because we spoke about, I don't know, I guess it was a couple of months ago on the Majority Report, I received a letter that similar podcasts have, and I want to talk about why us, but my good friend Mark Maron as well, who has quite a big podcast, received a letter from a company called Personal Audio claiming that the idea of podcasting, which I know many people listen to Tom Hartman that way and a lot of other liberal talkers, the idea of podcasting is patented. How is this possible?
Well, that's a really good question. And, you know, frankly, it's a symptom of a system that's gone awry in many ways. Personal Audio claims that it invented podcasting back in the 90s. Of course, it never really had a podcast. There's no proof that it actually ever podcast anything. So it's hard to understand its claim that it invented the technology. But we see this all the time. We see really broad patents, particularly that cover software-type technologies. And the owners claim that they cover all kinds of things that weren't contemplated when they were first written, essentially. So that's kind of what we've got in this case. And then when those patents fall into the hands or are in the hands of what we affectionately call patent trolls, they're used, frankly, as weapons, as tools to extort settlements and licenses from, you know, podcasters like you, unfortunately.
All right. So, and, you know, I want to get into just, again, the nature of this claim, because when you say technology, are they even, you know, when they, and they've now sent me multiple letters, which I have put into the round filing bin, asking me to check with my patent attorney about, are they patenting a technology when they patent the idea of someone listening to serialized audio segments that are some way get to your listening device? I mean,
Well, I would say they claim that they've patented that, but here's what's important, I think, in a case like this. What this company, Personal Audio, is doing in many instances is taking advantage of the fact that in order for you or someone in your position to show that either the patent is invalid, which we think it likely is, or that you don't infringe, you'd have to actually go to court and make that case, spend millions of dollars, and literally spend years of your life doing that. That just doesn't make any sense. So Personal Audio and companies like it take advantage of these economics and say, just pay us to go away instead. We'll take a couple $1,000, $10,000, $20,000. It's way cheaper than litigating.
And so is that why, I mean, I've noticed they've sued some podcasts from like some big companies that Discovery and I guess NBC and Adam Carolla, who's got a fairly, you know, got a pretty big operation. Do they then send, I mean, do they do that to make it look like they will come after someone like me? Because clearly they can't believe that Sam Seder doing the majority report is going and giving them a license fee is going to be as lucrative as it would be if I was NBC or not just me, you know, Tom Hartman for that matter. I mean, you know, we're not talking millions of dollars being generated through podcasts here.
Right. I think so. You know, there are a couple things that Personal Audio could be up to here. Frankly, it's hard to know what its motivation is. But, you know, some people say that they try this kind of dual strategy, some actual lawsuits, some just letters to do exactly what you're saying. They can use the lawsuits to threaten people in your position to pay up. Or sometimes they say that they use, you know, some of the conventional wisdom is maybe they use the letters to get fees to actually pay for the litigation. It's hard to know what their intention is, but, you know, you make a really good point. What most of the podcasters are earning, even the most successful podcasters, doesn't justify spending millions upon millions of dollars in federal court litigation. So you've got to ask yourself what's going on here. And we do this every day. I ask myself every day what's going on here. And the truth is a lot of it doesn't make any sense. It's, you know, it's finding loopholes in a legal system that allow people to make a quick buck. And it's become a really dangerous tax on innovation in this country.
And you know, and there are a myriad of problems that I see with patents across the board. This is simply one niche of it that you happen to focus on. The EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, for people who don't know it, is a wonderful organization that fights for all sorts of free freedoms and rights for journalists and for users of the internet and for a more open society and free flow of information and for simply more sort of pragmatic laws that aren't so influenced. I mean, when we have a patent system, like I know on one end we see patents that are extended for copyrights because a company like Disney, let's say, wants to maintain, generating money off this stuff. It's not like it's going to inhibit the innovation of cartoons. On the other end, we have these type of patents, which clearly do infringe upon innovation. What is the genesis of those type of laws? Why do we still have those type of laws?
So here's the thing. Patent system is in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 says that Congress can grant these monopolies in order to help the progress of useful arts and sciences. So think for a second about pharmaceuticals, which is really different than software, right? Think about pharmaceuticals, which are really hard to develop. They take tons of investment. Let's say you're a drug company and you want to come up with a new drug, and you put in, you know, oftentimes around $1 billion into your R&D costs. You have to take that drug through 3 rounds of testing at the FDA. And oftentimes, even after all of that investment, the drug won't end up on the market. So you can understand why maybe as a society we'd want to incentivize that type of R&D so that we can incentivize these companies to, you know, get new drugs to the market, right? There are problems with that system as well, but you can kind of understand theoretically.
I understand the basic theoretical aspect of it. To the extent that there's abuses, we know where it comes from because they want more patent protection and they want to go off-label and whatnot. But in this case,
what we've seen, I should say really quickly, I'm sorry, just to get in there, is that that whole system falls apart with software. It falls apart. The patents don't make sense. The technology moves so quickly. We're trying to incentivize different kinds of development. So what happens is we have all these, frankly, crappy patents floating around out there, and they end up in the hands of bad players, like in this instance, Personal Audio. But there are countless patent trolls out there who are doing similar things. Some of them, frankly, even kind of worse.
I can only imagine, but we got only 2 minutes left here. First, tell me what is happening in Congress to fight this, and then I want to hear about what you guys have been doing because this is a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, so Congress, first of all, what's going on in Congress is kind of amazing too. There's about 5 different legislative proposals floating around right now, both in the House and the Senate, both parties. It's a really bipartisan issue still, which is, you know, frankly, pretty refreshing. And the various proposals get at the patent troll business model. We think all of them are pretty good. None is perfect, but none is horrible yet. So we're working really hard with folks on the Hill to keep those bills moving forward, and the ones that we think will be more effective, keeping them relevant. Also,
in 30 seconds, tell us what the EFF is doing for podcasts, because this is great.
So EFF has partnered with a big law firm out here in the Bay Area, and we are going to try and kill this podcasting patent. So we're asking folks to help us develop what's called prior art. Give us proof that there's nothing new here. We think that podcasting is not a new invention. We don't think personal audio came up with it. We're collecting proof to bring to the patent office. You can help us by going to EFF.org/savepodcasting, EFF.org/savepodcasting.
We'll post that up on TomHartmann.com, and of course it'll be at MajorityReportRadio.com. Julie Samuels, thank you so much for your time
today.
Help us maintain Tom's and my podcasts.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartmann. I'll take your calls, 866-987-TOM. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartmann. Number's 866-987-TOM. Also have 866-745-CONS. Always welcome an opportunity to talk to a conservative or libertarian individual. I'm not sure to what the difference is sometimes, but they can, by all means, call us at 866-987-TOM and tell me a couple of things to mention today in the news. Senator Frank Lautenberg, five-term senator from New Jersey, has died today at age 89. He was a big champion of Amtrak, which I have a strong appreciation for. In addition to loving trains, I think that we should have a lot better train service in this country. We certainly need it. It would certainly help for the type of development that we're going to need to sustain over the years to come. He also championed things like gun control when it dealt with people who were engaged in domestic violence. He was great on issues of tobacco, and I think he was actually better. You know that he was senator for three terms back in the 80s and 90s. He left, retired, and then apparently regretted it from the moment that he left when Torricelli, the senator who replaced him in New Jersey, decided to resign rather than, I think, face a myriad of corruption charges. Lautenberg jumped back in. This was back in 2002. He was reelected in 2008, and so he will be missed. And the real question is going to be, what is Governor Christie going to do in terms of replacing him? Governor Christie is to appoint someone who will sit as acting senator until a special election in November, and then that person will serve only till 2014. But here's the catch, is that Chris Christie, sort of caught in some respects between a rock and a hard place, he wants to project this moderate image to the country, despite the fact that he's been engaged in a lot of right-wing policies in New Jersey. Simultaneously, he has to project an image of being a right-wing red meat eater to the base of the Republican Party, or he will not make it through the primaries. And he also wants to win in his reelection bid in November of this year by a wide margin. Now, if he places a Democrat in there, he's going to be in big trouble. If he appoints, let's say, Cory Booker, for instance, who is a little bit more corporatist than I would like, but for the sake of politics, let's discuss. What's going to happen is he's going to alienate his right-wing base for that presidential run in 2016. If, however, he puts a Republican in there, it's going to create a very contested election in 2013, and that may mobilize people and bring down Governor Christie's margin of error, or margin of win, or may actually threaten his reelection in some fashion. So my guess is he's going to put in some Republican who's going to say, I'm going to step down I'm not going to seek election in November 13th of this year, so that it makes that race a little bit less intense, but we shall see. Also, as Victoria Jones mentioned to us earlier in the program, Bradley Manning trial begins today. Unprecedented charges by the U.S. government seeking to charge a guy who is a, by any accounts, I mean, he's admitted to leaking. Even if you stipulate that he's a leaker, not a whistleblower, which I don't necessarily do, the idea that they would charge this guy with espionage is pretty stunning and really sends a bad message to the sanctity of reporting in this country. And I happen to think much of this is about trying to tie Bradley Manning into WikiLeaks in a way that U.S. prosecutors have been unable to do. And I think WikiLeaks represents a real threat to the national security apparatus, or at least is perceived by them as a real threat. Not necessarily even WikiLeaks, but that type of entity. Because while testimony by government prosecutors in this Bradley Manning case, or at least in the pretrial hearings, says that the government perceives WikiLeaks like the New York Times or Washington Post, they know they can go to the New York Times and Washington Post and negotiate the release of things that their reporters have found. I don't think they feel like they can do the same when it comes to WikiLeaks. So I think they're particularly concerned about that. Also, the Supreme Court decides that DNA swabs, that's just like fingerprints, even though fingerprints can ID you. DNA is something that is investigatory. And oddly enough, Antonin Scalia wrote the dissent in this case, was joined by Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg. And he wrote a pretty compelling dissent. It's one of the few times, ladies and gentlemen, where I will, I imagine, ever agree with Antonin Scalia. It's a little bit terrifying that that's the case, but it is, folks. And also, I just want to, and we'll take some calls in the next, I want to read this, because this gets to my point that I often argue with libertarians and conservatives, for that matter, and it was pretty stunning when I found out who it was from. It was from a graduate to the graduating class of Princeton University. The concept of success leads me to consider so-called meritocracies and their implications. We have been taught that meritocratic institutions and societies are fair. Putting aside the reality that no system, including our own, is really entirely meritocratic, meritocracies may be fairer and more efficient than some alternatives, but fair in an absolute sense? Think about it. A meritocracy is a system in which the people who are luckiest in their health and genetic endowment, luckiest in terms of family support, encouragement, and probably income, luckiest in their educational and career opportunities, and luckiest in many, so many other ways difficult to enumerate, these are the folks who reap the largest rewards. Was this Chris Hayes? No, in fact, it was Ben Bernanke. We got to take a break. I want to hear what you think about this. Pretty stunning from him, of all people.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman. Call me now, 866-987-TOM. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Tom Hartman. I'm on loan from the Majority Report at majorityreportradio.com or majority.fm. Check me out there daily. Let's go to the phones. The number's 866-987-TOM. And let's talk to Donald calling from Oak Brook, Illinois on WCPT. Welcome to the program, Donald.
How do you do? You know, what Bernanke, you see, said, was that a statement, or was he saying that that's the way it should be?
Well, Bernanke was making a statement in an address to the graduating class at Princeton University, and he was basically questioning the foundations of our so-called meritocracy, and he's right to do so. I just got to say, pretty surprising, and I don't know if this is a function of him taking a look in the mirror when he woke up in the morning going, I've really helped out these bankers quite a bit, and they're the ones who destroyed this economy. well, what are you going to do? Off to deliver my commencement address. But that's what's being reported in the Post anyways.
Oh, boy. Well, anyways, one other comment I want to make. What's going on in Wisconsin with their mayor, or rather their governor, from what I just heard on the news, I don't feel sorry for the people of Wisconsin. They deserve every bit of it because, you know, they put this clown in, and, you know, they get exactly what they get, what they're going to get from them. And this is just the prelude of what's going to take place should the Republicans take over completely.
I certainly agree with you on the second accord. I mean, look, I agree with you that, you know, you reap what you sow here. I think a lot of people, sadly, in Wisconsin were voting against the idea of recall as much as they were voting for Scott Walker that when they were faced with that recall election. There's a lot of people who think that the energy there could have been put in place, could have been used in a different way, in a more productive way, rather than fighting for a recall, fighting against his reelection, or fighting in other areas, building more relationships with the community. But, I mean, look, it's easy to second guess in hindsight, but certainly the Republican agenda is not going to moderate itself, folks. Folks are going to have to stand up, and when they have the opportunity to vote a right-wing reactionary out of office, they should take it. Otherwise, they're going to find themselves living like a situation we see, whether it's in Michigan or in Wisconsin or in Ohio or in Florida or in North Carolina or in Georgia, whatnot. Let's go to Michael Collin from Free Speech TV from California. Welcome to the program, Michael. Michael, are you there? All right, no Michael. All right, Michael, we'll have to move on. Let's go to Karen calling from Free Speech TV in Taos, New Mexico. Welcome to the program, Karen.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
I called that because you asked what the benefits were from the GMOs. And I only see that the benefit has been to Monsanto. I took a course at the University of New Mexico for sustainable food farming and learned more than most people would ever want to know about GMOs and the problems that we've had with the GMO crops. Now, the gene that they have engineered into these crops makes the crop resistant to Roundup.
Indeed.
And it saved a lot of money in labor because they can spray all the Roundup that they want to on it, and it does not kill the crop. Now, we had at one time like over 100 varieties of corn. Native varieties for different parts of the country and so forth. They're now having monoculture to where they're growing this corn that if it fails, it would be disastrous.
Yeah, this is the problem. I mean, you know, I and Karen, you know, everything that I have read about this suggests that what you're talking about is accurate. And I'm curious, okay, so one of the benefits, arguably, and I don't necessarily see it as a benefit, is that their labor costs have gone down. But I don't think that we have seen any type of real reduction in the prices of these crops as a function of GMOs. So the real question that needs to be answered by the GMO folks, in light of the fact that we know there are problems when it comes to creating a monoculture, in light of the fact that we know that there are problems in terms of creating these superbugs, is what's the benefit? What is the benefit? And why should we give such incredible sort of liability protection to this company? It seems absurd. Let's go to Frank calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts, watching on Free Speech TV.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling
in. Something to I think I should bring up to clarify this issue and maybe find out for myself. But in Al Franken, when he was sharing this radio, the same radio time. When he's a senator from Wisconsin. When he was chairing Minnesota. The same radio time that you, Tom Franken is, Tom Hartman is, he brought this up. Here's what happened. In 1986,
Frank, make a, we don't have too much time, but we, cut to the...
Okay, here's the deal. This thing that they say is going broke is a fund that they're talking about that was brought about by Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan to help to pay for the baby boomers. The rising population. That's going broke.
Well, okay, Frank, let me address this for you, all right? I will. I know what you're talking about. It was actually in 1983. It was the Greenspan Commission, which was looking at the long-term solvency of Social Security, knowing that we were dealing with a demographic shift. The baby boomers were going to enter into retirement. They were obviously a big bulge in our population. And so what they did is they raised, and I know this is going to be hard for conservatives to hear, but under Ronald Reagan, we had one of the largest tax increases in the modern era, and that is raising the percentage of money which is withheld both from employer and employee in Social Security, and this created the Social Security Trust Fund. There is now about $2.6 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund in government bonds, which provide interest. These are higher interest bonds than you could buy today. It is a third source of revenue for Social Security in addition to its taxation revenue streams. It is the case that in about 5 or 6 or 7 years, maybe 8 years, this fund will be exhausted, or I should say it will be primarily exhausted. It will reach essentially until 2033. If we do nothing else to shore it up. But it doesn't matter. I should say, it is not the full funding of Social Security. At one point, the fund will be, we will be taking more out of the fund. By 2033, it will be exhausted. And then the revenue stream that is the fundamental revenue stream of Social Security, that is taxes, will fund Social Security to about 77% of benefits. But this won't happen for 20 years in the mid-level conservative projections. So, yes, the idea of when you hear people say worker ratio has changed, there's only, one worker for every 3 person who's going to retire, 5 person who's going to retire in years to come. You got to ask that person, do you think the actuaries who were working on this 30 years ago or 50 years ago or 10 or 15, do you think they were not aware of the baby boom? Do you think they were not capable of addition and subtraction, basic numbers? Of course they were. And so because of a rise in worker productivity, those ratios are meaningless. All you need to know are the projections for solvency. All right, let's take a... let's go to George calling from WWRL in Aberdeen, New Jersey. Welcome to the program, George.
How you doing, Sam? I'd like to thank you for filling in for Tom today.
Ah, my pleasure. Thank you for calling, George.
I have a couple comments on Senator Frank Lautenberg, who passed away this morning.
Please.
He was one of the best senators ever in the state of New Jersey. This man woke up every morning and fought for the people of this great state. He got federal money to rebuild roads. As you mentioned before, he got federal money to keep Amtrak running. These are all necessities to the quality of life here in the state. Now, one thing you mentioned about Governor Christie, he's going to appoint probably some Republican shill that has made big contributions to his campaign. The people of New Jersey really need to see what Christie has done since he's been elected. And the fact of the matter is he's done very little.
Yeah, George, I couldn't agree with you more. I appreciate the phone call. And I got to say, for a guy who really was such an impressive senator, Lautenberg got a lot less attention than other New Jersey politicians. And maybe that's because of some of the causes he championed. I don't know. But we'll be right back after this message. We are back. Sam Seder filling in for Tom Hartman on loan from the Majority Report at MajorityReportRadio.com. Let's go to the phone. Speaking of which, it is Jeremo calling on calling from Yorktown Heights, New York. Jeremo, I should full disclosure. Jeremo is a regular caller to my daily program, the Majority Report. Jeremo, welcome to the show.
Hello, Sammy. Great to hear you. Great show.
Well, great to hear your voice, Jeremo. How are you?
Good. I'm fine. Sammy, I got permission from the screener that I'm allowed to give you a plug in the Majority Report show, a plug, podcast. Give them a plug also.
All right. Well, I appreciate that.
So real quick, you know, Sammy, I've been listening for about, what, 3 or 4 years now. Sammy, you are the great communicator.
All right, well, thank you, Jeremo. But let's talk. What did you have a point you want to talk about economics today?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Boy, you can't take any credit. Okay, real quick, Sammy. Last week we had Libertarian Matt call, and he berated you because you are irresponsible. You are irresponsible because you don't know basic economics. I was jumping out of my skin. I just couldn't believe what this guy was trying to pull. And it was so sad. And I'd like to have your comment.
Well, I appreciate the call, Jeremo. And, you know, it's hard talking about something when the rest of the audience hasn't heard it. But, you know, one of the things that people need to be aware of and is that for better or for worse, I would argue in many respects for worse, the younger folks in this country are attracted to a libertarian message, in part because there are some issues where libertarians are correct. I don't think it's because necessarily the libertarianism. There are many issues in which I would agree with a libertarian. I'm a liberal or a leftist, if you will, and so it's clearly not libertarianism. But this notion that we can have free markets, that they even exist, that we should want them, that we can trust corporations to self-regulate or the market to self-regulate, is fantastical. It is fanciful. And I'm just constantly shocked when I speak to libertarians on my program, and for some reason we do get a lot of them call in, just how fantastical and fanciful their notions are. And it's a very dangerous ideology in my estimation, because you don't get any benefit on the road there. There, you can never get to their utopia. And that's probably the case with all of our utopias, right? I mean, I don't know that we'll ever live in a world where it's just peace exists. But en route to trying to promote peace, you have less war. And that is good. En route to the libertarian utopia, what you have is basically feudalism. And that's what's really problematic about that ideology in my mind. Let's go to William calling from Coos Bay, Oregon, listening on KBBR. Welcome to the program, William.
Good afternoon, counselor. I'll get right to the point. I do listen to your Ring of Fire broadcast, and I appreciate your thorough investigation of everything and through Freedom of the Press as well. Purpose of my telephone call, Sam, is the guest that you had on earlier concerning the initial conversation concerning genetically modified seed stocks, it is, first of all, in reportage, and one could go to Foreign Nation, United Kingdom, Cambridge University, also here through the Centers for Disease Control, World Health Organization, and also other publications, the journal Science of Nature, that genetically modified foods have been linked to obesity, that they have been linked to, now this is purported, this needs to be verified, but
right.
This is purported, to obesity, to miscarriages in women, to lower, much lower semen counts in the anatomy of males, and that also that this is canceling out something that nature inserted, the reproduction processes of rhizomes, of other types of seeds.
And, William, all right, let me say this about that, and I appreciate the phone call, and I think, you know, clearly there needs to be more study about health impacts. I'm not surprised about the obesity because, frankly, just the production of cheap corn and our subsidies to corn have contributed quite a bit to obesity. As far as miscarriages or lack of fertility or whatnot, I haven't seen the data on that, and I imagine that's a pretty tricky thing at this point in the history of these crops to isolate. Nevertheless, I don't even think that we need to make that argument because we just don't know the health impacts. And that, but we do know, what we do know for sure is the ecological impacts. We do know, by definition, if you have cornered the market on the seeds of a commodity like wheat, in other words, if 90% of the wheat produced in this country or corn is Monsanto corn, we are creating a monoculture that is extremely vulnerable to severe changes in weather. It is vulnerable to the evolution of pests and insects and other viruses. This is very problematic. I mean, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You don't need to be a genius to know that that's problematic. So the real question is, why it is that Monsanto has been able to game the system so well that they have escaped things like liability. If there are health consequences, why they have been received such protection from our government. I think it comes back to the fact that income inequality breeds political inequality. And we have a problem with corporate influence in this country. Just want to thank Tom and Shane and Sean and Danielle and Matt and Michael here from the Majority Report in New York with me for all their help today. Always a pleasure filling in for Tom Hartman. A real honor. You can check me out at the Majority Report at majorityreportradio.com. Tom's got a great audience, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it. So Tom will be back later in the week, of course.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.